Good evening and welcome to episode 5 of the Borussia Dortmund London Fan Club podcast. And this evening, I have with me my co-host, Mark Shepherd. Hello, Mark.
Good evening, Ben. How are we doing?
Great to have you on the show again. We've got lots of topics to talk about, but let me introduce the guests first. We have a gentleman we had on a couple of weeks ago, Mr. Konstantin Ekner, who many will know from the Yellow Wall podcast and Talking Fußball. Hi, Konstantin.
Hi, guys. How are you doing?
Good. Excellent. Been catching some fun today. And then last but not least, somebody who I've very much wanted to interview for a long time, one of the history writers, really, of Borussia Dortmund, who's recently written the Chronicle of Borussia Dortmund. I would say the definitive Chronicle of Borussia Dortmund, and quite a tome it is too, several hundred pages, as well as several other books about Borussia Dortmund, books about Celtic, Liverpool, Jurgen Klopp, and even a book about FC Bayern, but we won't hold that against him. Good evening, Mr. Dieter Marmeling, Schulze Marmeling.
Okay.
How are you?
Fine, thanks. Thank you.
And you're in Münster tonight, right?
Close to Münster. It's Altenberge. Translation would be Old Mountain. It's 15 kilometers northwest of Münster on the way to Enschede, to the Netherlands.
Ah, Netherlands, yes, indeed. And are you in, Konstantin, are you in Berlin tonight again?
I'm in Berlin. We'll be off to Frankfurt tomorrow to cover the match, the evening match for BBC.
Oh, that's absolutely outstanding. Well, we're honored that you found time for us. I know you have a pretty busy schedule. And Mark, you're in the country, in the English countryside, I guess. I hope you've got a nice pot of ale, real ale, in front of you.
Well, I wish I did, actually. I have to confess, it's an Italian lager that's sitting in front of me at the moment. If I could lay my hands on some Dortmund beer, I would do. But unfortunately, that's not so easy. With the exception of up in London, when we meet up at the fan club, then I can get hold of some.
And talking about the fan club, let's get into the show tonight. So really, the show tonight is all about the writing of Dieter, and really just discussing the football club that he's been following since 1963, I believe. Dieter will correct me on that.
No, it's since season 65-66. When Borussia was the first German team that won a European competition, the Cup Winners' Cup, since then.
Absolutely. All right, over to you, Mark. Let's get Dieter let's get some history perspectives. Yeah. Dieter, I'm so looking forward to reading your book, I have to say.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Ben. So, Dieter, you've written many books on football. I guess to start off, how did you get started as an author, and what drove you to write about football in particular?
I think it was in the age of 31 or 32. Look, I became a football supporter, a Borussia Dortmund supporter, as I already mentioned, in 65-66. My first game was ended with a defeat. It was against 1860 Munich, some days after Borussia Dortmund won the European Cup in Hampden Park, and they lost this game and lost the championship. And I went to Borussia Dortmund games on a regular basis until 76, yes, the year when they were promoted back to the first division. And afterwards, I became more interested in politics, in music, in girls, of course, and so on. And in 88, it was in 88, I moved to Northern Ireland with my wife. My wife worked there as a doctor in the border town Newry, in the hospital there. And I worked as a journalist covering the troubles, writing books about the troubles, and so on. And became very interested in the connection between sports and politics, particularly the three Northern Irish ball games, Gaelic football, rugby, and football, how they are connected with politics. And then we remember the Hillsborough disaster, and perhaps you know, or I'm convinced, you know, that there is a Hillsborough in Northern Ireland. And I will never forget this day. I was sitting in front of our flat in Newry, and a colleague of my wife passed by and told me, look, there are more than 90 people killed in Hillsborough. And in this moment, I thought it would be Hillsborough in Northern Ireland, and there would be had been an IRA attack, terrorist attack. But because I didn't know that Hillsborough was the name of the stadium of Sheffield Wednesday. And I was very impressed about the behavior of the players, the Liverpool players, the people of Liverpool, etc. And then I wrote my first article about football, where I tried to discuss what happened in Hillsborough in a wider context, in a political, social, cultural context, and sent it to some papers in Germany. And I was surprised, were very impressed about this. And when I came back to Germany, you know, before I worked for some years in peace and conflict research, I wasn't interested anymore in this subject, and wanted to start to write a bit more about football. And my first football book was then in 92, the book Der gezähmte Fußball. We translated Tamed Football, a modest attempt to write the social history and political history of the game. And this book was, it was very successful. And that was the start of my career as football writer. But as I said, it was in 90 or 91, so quite late, and I was already 34, 35.
Yeah, it's probably quite late in many ways to sort of get into,
It would never happen without going to Northern Ireland and without the Hillsborough disaster, yeah. I have to say.
Yeah. So it's the effect of Hillsborough, and obviously getting to know a lot of elements around Liverpool as a city and the people and the football club. Is that a team now that you sort of have a soft spot for and somebody you follow quite closely?
I wouldn't say I follow them. I'm very interested in the history of the club. And, you know, the Liverpool was quite successful at the time when we were in Northern Ireland in 88 and 89 with Kenny Dalglish as player, manager, etc. And I was more Manchester United because of George Best and Bobby Charlton, etc. And the Munich disaster. United was very popular in Germany in the 60s because of the Munich disaster, because of World Cup 66, because of then of Best, of course, Bobby Charlton, etc. And therefore, I was more a fan of the style United played, than which was more entertaining than the passing game of Liverpool. So it was more United than Liverpool.
Yeah. Okay. I've got some sort of real, very distinct memories of that time around Hillsborough. On the day of Hillsborough, and I think it was April the 15th, 1989, if memory serves, I was actually at a match in England, down in London, between Arsenal and Newcastle, which was a league game. And the news filtered through, and it was a season that Arsenal themselves were doing very well in the league. And obviously, it culminated with a rearrangement of all the fixtures that meant that Liverpool and Arsenal would play each other on the last game of the English season.
Yeah, I remember that game.
And the closest finish, as it turns out, to any title race has ever been in English history. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was at that game as well on that Friday evening, the 26th of May, 89, and standing in the Arsenal end as an Arsenal fan, and Liverpool basically had to literally turn up. They could afford to lose 1-0, and the title was theirs. Yeah. Arsenal won the game miraculously, as you know, in the dying seconds, 2-0. One of the amazing things I found, though, was that at the end of the game, you know, here's a Liverpool side who have you know, been through this terrible tragedy. They've now lost the league right at the death, and at a time when English football itself as well had been through some terrible troubles in terms of hooligan elements, etc. Yeah. But some of the fans and the police let them do this, walked from the Kop, and they walked the full length of the pitch to where the Arsenal fans were standing in the Anfield Road section, and actually just came in and shook their hands to say congratulations, you've won the league title. And for Arsenal, it was a big deal. It was the first time they won the championship for 18 years. And it was an amazing gesture. And as an English football fan, it was something that for me felt like it was a huge positive that had come out of something terrible. It was like a turning point, because I remember visiting Anfield back in the early 80s, and we were quite scared to go there because we'd get off the buses, go to the away end, and we'd be sort of frightened of being attacked potentially. But after, from that day forward, everything completely changed. So it was a terrible disaster, but I think there were many positives that came out of it in the end. And as you quite rightly said before, I think Liverpool as a city and as a football club have come out with tremendous credit since.
It's true.
Yeah, and I guess what could also be said, is that disaster, was probably the nail in the coffin of standing, of safe standing in English football, with 96 people. Was it 94? 94 people.
96.
96, that's right. 96, yeah, because... which is now being trialed again at Shrewsbury and Celtic and so on. But let's move on. I know that, Dieter, you wrote a book about George Best, who died in 2005. One of the saddest things for me was my mum actually met George Best around 2000 and came home one evening and said, "I've got an autograph for you." It was on the back of a menu. And at the time, I didn't necessarily, being a former Man U star, I didn't really necessarily treasure it. And now I'm kicking myself at George Best. I mean, what a legend. Funnily enough, I used to drink at a pub just off the King's Road that he used to go to. Again, I can't remember what that was called, but by the end of the show, I shall certainly be able to remember.
Yeah, I know, but I don't remember the name, but it's not exactly on the King's Road, but it's in Chelsea. And
that's it. That's it, just off the King's Road. You've been there as well. He used to spend a lot of time there, didn't he, with some of those boys from back in the era. Yeah, it'll come back to me. It'll come back to me. So just coming back to Borussia Dortmund, basically. So talk to us a bit, Dieter, about your early memories of BVB. So really, essentially... the beginnings of BVB. How old were you when you started going to watch Borussia?
It was 9 years old. 9 years old when I started. And as I mentioned, the first game was against 1860 Munich. And the following years were not very impressive, and they ended in relegation to the second division in 72. And it was a hard time because we all thought, of course, that this club would have a big future after winning the European Cup in 66. I think the thing was at that time that the board wasn't prepared to invest money in the team. Therefore, they couldn't capitalize on what happened in Hampden Park. And it's very sad, but it explains a bit what happened then in the 90s with Gerd Diebaum, because Gerd Diebaum, the president then in the late 80s, early 90s, he was among those supporters in the mid-60s, and he didn't want to commit the same mistake like the board did in after 66. But of course, I always cut his term in office in two halves. The first one was good, and the second one was terrible.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I've just looked it up. The pub was called the Feeney, Arms.
Yeah, the Feeney.
And I have the tragic news that it was closed down the year that George Best died. So we'll never be drinking in George Best's footsteps anymore, Dieter. so a period, I interviewed a player called Alphonse Sicora last year. Probably very obscure. I don't think even Constantine has heard of Alphonse Sicora, have you?
No, not really.
And okay. Alphonse played
for... It was shortly before my time, actually.
Well, I was always fascinated by Borussia Dortmund in the Zweite Liga. And they spent, what, 4 years in the Zweite Liga between 72 and 76? And it was Zweite Liga Nord. Is that right?
No, it was even worse. First, it was the Regionalliga West.
West, and then...
They had five second divisions at the time. And then from 74 on, it was the Zweite Bundesliga Nord. That's right, yes.
Yeah. And there were some remarkable teams that they used to play against and so on. Sikora came in. He was supposedly going to be the new Ziggy Held, which were pretty big shoes to wear.
Oh, yes. Too big.
Too big. And he ended up going on to Erste FC Mülheim, who now play in the Kreisliga.
Yeah. Mülheim
Sturm. That's it. Absolutely. Okay. Anyway, what were your experiences of the 1970s, of Borussia Dortmund before they were promoted to the first division? Did you watch any of the matches at the Stadion Rote Erde?
Yes, I loved the stadium. In fact, I found it wonderful, the stadium, although it has its running track. Yes, I watched every game at home and abroad in the season 75-76. The season when they were back promoted to the first division, but not so many in the Regionalliga West. So after they were relegated in 72, not so many games.
Yeah.
But 75, 76, they were moving to the Westfalenstadion, stadium, to the new stadium. There was a lot of excitement about the South Stand, etc. And big crowds. I remember a game against Arminia Bielefeld. Against Gütersloh, it was on a Tuesday or Wednesday night with more than 50,000 people in the second division. It was incredible at the time.
Incredible. And yet the average attendance in the Zweite Liga, particularly in the Regionalliga West, I think was round about 10,000.
It was low. Yeah, it was very low. I remember there was one game against Preußen Münster and the crowd was 1,500.
Yeah, the final game of the season, I think, of...
Yeah, 9-0 against Preußen Münster, yes.
72-73. So, Alfons Sikora talked a lot about the time, about the 1970s being a time of financial instability. Indeed, last week on the show with Nick Wildhagen, we talked about how Dortmund were one of the first teams to have an emblem on the front of their shirt, and they introduced the name Dortmund, the word Dortmund, onto the back of their shirts. As a recognition for a 1 million Deutschmark loan that was given to the team by the city of Dortmund.
The city of Dortmund, yeah, right.
Yeah.
First, they had, they got support from the city of Dortmund, and they even changed the crest. There was a lion for 2 years, they had a lion. Because of their connection to tobacco factory, Samsung.
The Dutch tobacco factory, and then the episode with the lion itself. Some pretty amazing...
Red Bull, but it already happened in the 70s.
It does. It brings back Red Bull, doesn't it? Definitely. And then, in essence, basically, the Westfalenstadion and the World Cup of 1974 was the kind of big thing that changed. It kind of lifted Dortmund back up. And I believe, Dieter, that the Dortmund were not initially selected to be a stadium for the World Cup 74, and then basically had to build this entire stadium for the World Cup.
Yeah, that's true. And that was very important for Borussia Dortmund. Because the star was at the time the stadium, not the team. And it brought back the crowds to the games. And it was the only, if you look at the eight stadiums at World Cup 74, it was the only football stadium. All the others had running tracks, but this was the only football stadium.
Yeah, yeah. And can you remember your first match when you came from, you had been going to the Stadion Rote Erde, now has a capacity of 9,999. Indeed, I've played a few times there. In the Südtribünenmeisterschaft, the fan club tournament, I've played about five or six times, and it's always extraordinary to play in the stadium of Borussia Dortmund, to change in the changing rooms of the BVB Amateur second and so on. But in those days, when you were talking about this 1970s, there were vastly huge crowds in the Stadion Rote Erde, right? I mean, at times for certain matches. As you said, the average was not that high, but at times I've seen images from European Cup games and so on, really, I mean, quite extraordinary.
But not in the 70s.
No, in the European Cup campaign and so on, late 60s and so on.
Yeah,
They had crowds there in that stadium of like, what, 30, 40,000?
Even more. There's this famous game against Benfica. When they had Benfica 5-0. I think there were 45,000 to 50,000 people in the stadium. And the official capacity was 39 or 40,000, but there were 5,000 to 10,000 more people in the stadium at that time.
What was your first recollection then? Do you remember the first match you went to watch in the Westfalenstadion? I remember the opening match. I'm to say I remember. I wasn't there. I don't think I was actually born. 73, maybe just. Dortmund's first game was against Schalke tomorrow.
Schalke against Schalke, yes, yeah.
3-0. I think they lost. Right? Was that the opening game?
It was against Schalke. It was a friendly against Schalke. But I can't remember the result. I never can remember the result when it ended and games against Schalke 04 ended in a defeat.
That's a good omen for tomorrow. What were your memories of the first time in the Hallenstadion?
It was in the Zweite Bundesliga North, but I'm not. I think it was against Uerdingen, but I'm not sure. And it was. I think the crowd was 13 or 14,000, not that big. And it was a season, yes, it was a season 74, 75.
Yeah.
And so in that season, they had still these financial problems and no ambitions to be promoted back to the first division. It's all changed then in summer. And I think it was against Uerding, but I can't remember the result, the score, I can't remember.
And I remember interviewing Martin Kreh, the wonderful defender of Borussia Dortmund of 97 generation, for a special report I did about the 97 generation, the 20th year anniversary. And he talked a lot about Zoltán Varga, the Hungarian.
Zoltán Varga, yeah.
Genius, Tell me.
He was a genius, it's true. But he only spent, I think, a season in Dortmund, not more, or 1.5 season. But he was really brilliant and... a friend of mine, they had a dog and they named this dog Varga. But unfortunately, his friend became later on a Schalke 04 supporter, but the dog still carried the name Varga, Zoltán Varga.
Oh, this friend of yours switched from Dortmund to Schalke?
Pardon, what?
He switched from Dortmund to Schalke.
He switched from Dortmund to Schalke. Yes, I couldn't understand it, but he did so. Although he was at that time in the 70s, he was really a hardcore supporter who went to every home game, every game abroad. So, but he did. He committed.
Oh, yeah. The less said about him, the better. I think maybe we can agree on that. Constantine, do you have any special things that you'd like to bring up about the 1970s before Mark moves on to the 1980s?
In regards to Dortmund, not so much, actually. I mean, for me, the 1970s are probably, if you look at the decades of German professional football, post-war football, and then that's the one decade where Dortmund wasn't really of like national significance. And the 70s were really our teams. And I think when I think about the 70s, I think about the manipulation scandal, of course, with Offenbach and Bielefeld and so on. And I think that was because the Offenbach chairman Canalas is actually from my hometown. And when I was at school, I read about a famous football official. I've never heard about him when I was like 10, 11. That's why I got really into the story of the manipulation scandal. But no, that's one thing. And then another thing is really when you look today and you see all these Gladbach fans around Germany, even younger, even at my age and in their 20s, but their dads or moms even are also Gladbach fans. That's really stemming from the 70s when Gladbach, also Cologne and others, but really Gladbach made a run and gathered so many supporters across the West Germany, of course, across West Germany. So it's really that is one decade where Dortmund wasn't that prominent in like top flight football. And really, Gladbach was, in my opinion, there was always the one club, or especially following Bayern's really run at the international titles, and they were run in the early 70s with Beckenbauer and so on. And afterwards, we had always one club opposed to Bayern, and that was Gladbach at the time. And that's why. And I think today we see that a lot of people are into Dortmund now because of the Klopp years, but it was really similar to what Gladbach did, because there was a really exciting playing style. So I try the comparisons between 1970s Gladbach and the 2010 Dortmund, more or less. Yeah,
absolutely. That's a parallel that I drew in a recent article. In fact, I think it comes out next week, about the Jurgen Klopp's last season, 14-15, about how basically BVB, they inherited the spirit of the fallen elf. And, you know, those guys, Bertie Fuchs and Jupp Heynckes and so on. I mean, quite a remarkable, extraordinary Gladbach team that won the UEFA Cup two times, the Meisterschaft several times, Pokal and so on. A really extraordinary team. Was it Hennes Weisweiler who was the manager? Please forgive me if I've got that completely wrong.
But with whom? With Borussia?
The Gladbach manager at the time.
With Gladbach and then afterwards with Cologne.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
That's why I said he's really, that's what I meant when I said Weisweiler's playing style. That was really, he was linked to what Gladbach did in terms of how exciting and intense and also creative their style of football was. That was always a credit to him. Weisweiler is the brain behind the operation. You know, I think Weisweiler is in line with some other of German speaking coaches like Ernst Happler and so on. It's really innovative coaches. Who might be not Happel, but some others like Weisweiler might be a little bit forgotten today. Unfortunately, when people look back at German, I mean, of course, people know who Weisweiler is, but sometimes these names are a little bit forgotten today, and because how dominant Bayern Munich has been, and also in the popular history of German football.
Yeah. Absolutely. But I think, I mean, as you say, Gladbach is still a very well-supported team. I remember watching them in the old Bökelberg Stadion. And even when I was living in Dortmund in the 1980s and to mid-90s, Gladbach was still a force to be reckoned with their old Erdgas Trikots. How could we forget those? And they've always produced extraordinary players. I mean, think of Lothar Matthäus and so on. But anyway, Mark, over to you. Borussia Dortmund in the 1980s, a generation, I think, before. When did BVB come onto your radar, really? When was the first time that you noticed them, Mark?
Well, I think for me, probably late 80s to early 90s would be when they sort of hit the radar, as far as I'm concerned. I think, obviously, having read quite a bit about Borussia Dortmund since, you know, it was a tough time for the area through the 1980s when coal and steel production sort of came to almost a grinding halt in the area. So I think the area as a whole was going through a very rough period, and the team itself probably could best be described as quite mediocre, I suppose, through the sort of early to mid 80s. I can see Dieter there nodding with a little smile as well. And even in 1986, they came very, very close to being relegated again. And in fact, it was within seconds. It was a last sort of last minute equaliser rescued them.
Games I watched in the 80s, one of the few games. Game against, you know, that the 80s, two games against Fortuna Cologne. I suppose in England, no one knows who Fortuna Cologne is. They had to win it. And I think it was in injury time. It was the last, in fact, the last thing that happened in that game, that Cobra Bergmann scored the third goal. And so they get another chance and on a neutral venue in Düsseldorf. And then they bet Fortuna Cologne 8-0. I think it was 8-0.
Yeah, absolutely right.
But due to the fact that the opposition was caught by a flu, some important players of Cologne were sick. But nonetheless, but in fact, I would say it was a start of a new era, because this game, these relegation games changed the atmosphere in Dortmund completely, the mood completely. And I think it was only a season later that they qualified for the UEFA Cup, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Wasn't there a noticeable sort of pickup in attendance sort of the following season then?
Yeah,
sort of people started to really come and watch them again.
Yeah, they became very popular then, And the next one, of course, the next was the cup final in 89, of course. At that time, I still lived in Northern Ireland, but I spent the cup final weekend with a friend in Munster to watch the cup final on telly. Because at that time, of course, you couldn't watch German football in Northern Ireland on BBC or UTV. And I think this was very, very important. It was the first time, the first trophy since 23 years. The first time they won the National Cup, the DFB Cup, since 24 years. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's,
I think even more, 86 was even more important, the game, even more important than the cup final.
Yeah, I think... sort of come back to what you're saying, Ben, and I've spoken to quite a few BVB fans who sort of allude to that game as being probably one of the most important games in their history.
I think they were the underdog. Everyone most expected that Werder Bremen would win because Werder Bremen at that time, they had a great team, and so everyone expected that they would win, but then it was 4-1. It was Dickel's great game.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Werder were the champions, had been previous season the champions, and went in heavy favourites with Karl-Heinz Riedler.
Yeah, they were only serious challenge to Bayern Munich in this decade, Werder Bremen.
And, absolutely. And of course, a player at the time, Karl-Heinz Riedler, actually, I remember watching him playing for Blau-Weiß Berlin when Blau-Weiß Berlin got hammered 7-1 at the Westfalenstadion. That was quite a spectacle, I have to say. But amongst the players that really made a huge difference was Manfred Burgsmüller, a player who played for Werder Bremen and also for Borussia Dortmund for some years. Dieter, do you have some memories? I think all of us probably have memories of Manny Burgsmüller, whether we were around at the time or not. I mean, he's kind of like a huge legend of Borussia Dortmund.
Brilliant. Very entertaining, of course, and there's one game I remember. It was against Arminia Bielefeld when he scored, was it five or six games, six goals he scored?
I think five goals in the second half. In the 11-1 against
Arminia. At halftime, it was a draw, then they scored 10 goals within 45 minutes. Yeah, it was incredible.
Absolutely amazing, and I only just wish I'd been in the stadium to watch the game.
Absolutely. And then obviously that sort of, I guess that cup win then propelled them into, I guess, into the sort of glorious 90s. Ben, you must have absolutely loved watching BVB through the 90s. Just an incredible era for them.
I thought many Borussia Dortmund supporters were convinced that Borussia Dortmund would never be able to win the national championship, the league, would never. This was the past, and now it was Borussia Mönchengladbach, Bayern Munich, Hamburg SV, Cologne, Werder Bremen, but not Borussia Dortmund. Maybe we would qualify for the UEFA Cup, but impossible to win the championship. And when they did so in 95, for me it was a bit like the end of story, I have to admit. It was a fantastic moment, but at the same time, it was something like a sad moment. No, it had happened, what we've never expected. And if you look for the reasons, it had, of course, to do with Gerd Niebaum, the president at the time, who was a very ambitious man. And to understand his politics, we have to move back to 66. I already mentioned that Borussia Dortmund couldn't capitalize on Hampden Park, on the victory against Liverpool. They were very, on the transfer market, they were very reluctant, very conservative, and this all changed under Gerd Niebaum. And the board did invest. The stadium was small, it was extended. And As he called his project, was a refurbishment by investment, something like that.
Yeah.
And so his idea was completely different from the policy of the board in the 60s. And, you know, then there were the Italian returnees, Reuter, Möller, Sammer, Kohler, Riedle, German internationals who had spent some years in the Serie A, which was at that time the best league in the world. So they brought a lot of experience back to Dortmund. But of course, the team was very expensive. Very helpful was the UEFA Cup in 92-93. When they made it to the final and made a lot of money out of this campaign, because in this season they hadn't to share the income with other German clubs. I think it was 25 million, but so even 30 million D-mark they made in the season. Incredible sum of money at that time. And yeah, it was, of course, it was very successful. And then another reason, of course, is the manager, Ottmar Hitzfeld, who spent 6 years in Dortmund, a very, very long period. And I think it was even 7 years he spent then, or 7.5 years in two terms in Munich. Mm. So, yeah.
Yeah, the stadium was expanded from, what, 53,000 or was it 54,000?
At first it was reduced from 54,000 to 44,000,
yeah,
because of an increase of the seating capacity, and then it was extended up to 65,000 and then 81,000.
Yeah, that's right. I remember that very well with the open corners. The wind used to blow in from the corners. It could get pretty cold in the Westfalenstadion, yeah, in the 1980s.
And the extension was one reason for the financial problems they faced afterwards. But on the other hand, today we are very proud that we have this stadium.
Remarkable.
We have this capacity. Yeah.
Remarkable. Constantine, do you have any memories of the when was your first sort of match, really? I know you've been interested in BVB for quite some time.
Well, now we are talking about a time when I was actually alive, albeit really small. I mean, actually, the first match I consciously followed of Borussia Dortmund was the 1997 Champions League final. Really, what I really was watching and knowing this, that something was going on, something big was going on. But yeah, I mean, Dieter already expanded on what was happening throughout the 90s, especially the 93 UEFA Cup campaign, which helped Dortmund to get financially ahead. Especially, I mean, Bayern was struggling throughout during that time. Yeah. It wasn't that Bayern was ahead of the curve, as they have been for past 25 years, more or less 20 years, let's say that. So I was really propelling Dortmund to new heights. And I think what they did, as already mentioned, buying German players from Italy, like Andy Möller, in his second stint at Dortmund. I mean, he was someone who joined Dortmund when he was really young from Eintracht Frankfurt, went back to Frankfurt, then down to Juventus, and then came to Dortmund. Same with Julio Cesar joined him when joining Dortmund. And these players, I mean, the 1997 team was really strong, and it was filled with German players, but also with international players. Then you got the first really major downfall with the 1999-2000 campaign, the famous one when Udo Lattek and so on. Came in to rescue Dortmund, not really rescue, but rescue Dortmund from promotion, basically. Was the first, I think, major dip in performance. Dortmund recovered from that, but had to spend heavily. And yeah. I mean, up until the 2004-05 season, when really insolvency was a talking point, Dortmund was spending heavily. Not only on transfer fees for the Marcio Amoroso and so on, for the likes, but also was spending heavily on players' wages. Yeah. Niebaum and Meyer, Meyer being the financial expert, former company consultant, getting into football, first Cologne and later Dortmund. I mean, they were, when it came to financial planning, they were really aggressive. Their projections were that Dortmund was at minimum being runner up domestically, getting really deep and making deep runs internationally. So and that didn't really materialize a couple of seasons, And then they were were upside down financially, basically, Dortmund. And I mean, really being so aggressive in terms of financial planning was their downfall. Of course, Dieter alluded to that the 1966 and the aftermath of 1966 might be or was a mocking point for Niebaum and others, maybe not making the same mistakes, being too cautious, too hesitant, but then making basically making a 180 and making the exact opposite mistake, that. For instance, Schalke has done in the recent past sometimes with being too aggressive in terms of financial planning and projections. So it's really interesting to when you look at the 30-40 years of Dortmund history and how Dortmund twice experienced a downfall after a major success. In terms of the 90s and 2000s, in my opinion, two successes. I mean, the Champions League win and then even the 2002 campaign. Not winning the UEFA Cup, still being in the final, winning the championship with Matthias Sammer. I mean, it was still a huge success for Dortmund, in my opinion. And the team was great back then. I mean, that was the first really Dortmund team, me wearing a Thomas Rosicki jersey on the playing ground. But that was also a great team, but it was hugely expensive and it wasn't sustainable, I guess, in the long term, unless you are really winning multiple championships, which they didn't, of course.
Yeah, I think it had a bit to do with the Champions League. They became as what I call a Champions League club. A Champions League club needs a big squad, a big expensive squad, and so on, which guarantees you a place in this competition. But if this doesn't happen, you are in a financial trouble. And the mistake some clubs make then is that they even invest more money, that at least next time they will qualify for the Champions League. And but if it doesn't work, then you are in serious trouble.
Yeah. The question I had for the chaps,
I think this title of 2000 championship of 2002, it's a title between two periods, between the Niebaum period and the Watzke Klopp period, and of course overshadowed by the financial problems. And I sometimes get the impression that Borussia Dortmund fans don't like to talk about 2002. They talk about 95, the first team from the Ruhr Valley area, which is able to win the league in the moment where we all thought this would never happen to Schalke 04, not happen to Borussia Dortmund, and then the exciting Klopp team. But 2002, because it's connected to their financial trouble, and the team was so expensive, they don't like to talk about that.
Dieter, I was holding up your book earlier, Der Ruhm, der Traum und das Geld. In fact, I bought two of your books, as I mentioned. I sent you the photos on the internet. I moved back to England in 1991, and that was the season I was reading in your book. It completely went over my head. Fantastic reading about the Borussia Dortmund team of 91-92. Can you tell us a bit about this? I think everybody will, unless you particularly knew about this season, I think you'd be quite...
I think it was the first season after reunification with 20 teams in the league, and so 38 games. And they lost the championship on the last game. They won in Duisburg, but what was it? Frankfurt lost in Rostock, and Stuttgart, I think it was Sammer who scored the winner.
Yeah.
They won Leverkusen, and it was fantastic. It was incredible. We couldn't believe it that Borussia Dortmund on the last day they would have the chance to win the championship. And interesting because we mentioned Andy Möller. Before Andy Möller came back to Dortmund, people were convinced that with Andy Möller, Andreas Möller in your team, you cannot win a championship. That's impossible. Frankfurt, what happened to Frankfurt was evidence to that. And Niebaum told me, sometimes I met him, he told me, look, there's only one club with which Andy Möller can win a national championship. This is Borussia Dortmund. This came true. He won his first title. I think it was the only one in 96-2 with Borussia Dortmund. And I think this has to do with Ottmar Hitzfeld, who was very good in dealing with these so-called superstars. it was very good. In Dortmund, in like in Munich, very good.
What are your memories of meeting Gerd Niebaum, Dieter?
As I mentioned, I would cut his time at head of Borussia Dortmund in two halves, and the first one was good, with good idea, with a vision, and so on. And the first time, you see, today it's very difficult to meet Karl-Heinz Rummenigge or Aki Watzke and so on, and they would tell you, look, I have half an hour time, but not more. But the first time I met Niebaum, we spent 3 or 4 hours. It was incredible. Okay, yeah. But it wouldn't happen today, but it was at that time, it hadn't. And we had so many presidents that weren't that good at Borussia Dortmund, or had no idea, no vision what to do with that club, that I was very happy when Gerd Niebaum took over. As I said, the second half was terrible, and we should never forget the first half, and without this first half, Borussia Dortmund wouldn't, I think he was a man who brought Borussia Dortmund back on top of German football and in the European arena, this we have to admit.
I know that Mark has recollections of 97, and I'm always keen to get Mark's expertise on English football as well at the time, because it's such a wonderful contrast between English football and German football and so on. But one question I did want to ask you, Dieter, was in your book, there's some lovely photographs of especially one photograph of Marcel Raducanu playing against Bayern München, which I sent Marcel on the WhatsApp, and he really enjoyed seeing that photo again, where he's kicking the ball with his kind of heel, some kind of extraordinarily gifted player. But I was extremely surprised to see in the 95-96 season, a guy who I had the great, great blessing of playing with in Sheffield 2 years ago against the Traditionsmannschaft of Borussia Dortmund, and somebody who I've admired enormously forever, basically, since Günter Kutowski came onto the scene. One of the hard men of Dortmund's defences, and an incredibly good guy.
The last man in the squad who had this typical Ruhr Valley area, name, Kutowski, like Tilkovsky and so on, Flebrovsky, but he was from Paderborn, from East Westphalia. He was not from the Ruhr area. Yeah. The fighter.
And that's where he went back in the season 1995. He went back having won the DFB Pokal in 89 with the team. In 95, he went back, and yet he ended up somehow.
Became back from Northern Ireland in autumn 89, and then I started to go to the Borussia Dortmund home games at least. Yeah.
How did he end up on the Meisterschaftsfoto? Because at that time, I think he was playing for TuS Schloss Neuhaus, which then became Paderborn.
Kutowski.
Yeah.
He's on the 95 photo. He is, but I think he was.
He is. I'm going to have to ask him himself, I think.
Yeah, you have to ask himself. But I'm not sure. But in 94, 95, he was still with Borussia Dortmund, or?
Well, I'll come back to you. I'll come back to you by the end of the show with that information. But Mark, your recollections of Dortmund of 1997. I watched the final in a pub on the King's Road, having not really focused. It was my first years of university and in London, and I didn't really focus on football for that time. It was more kind of wine, women, and song, I have to say, like most students.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, first of all, if we just take one step back in 1997, Borussia Dortmund played Manchester United in the semi-finals.
Yes.
And I think in England at the time, and in English football, it was a time when Manchester United was starting to dominate English football. And they were all expecting sort of Fergie's team to then go on and win in Europe. But it took them quite some time to adjust to be able to achieve that. But the semi-final against Borussia Dortmund and going into that semi-final, I think particularly everybody in England thought that, you know, Manchester United are gonna roll BVB over without any problems at all. But actually, you know what, BVB did fantastically well defensively at Old Trafford in the semi-finals, nicked a goal, and then came back to Dortmund, and again they got a goal and put it beyond Manchester United. So I think first of all it was a fantastic achievement for them to get to the final. They then play Juve in the final, who, you know, what a team that was. If you look at the stars in that Juve team, and particularly, you know, one Zinedine Zidane playing in that team. But again, back in the UK, we have very fond memories of a certain Paul Lambert doing an absolutely wonderful marking job on Zidane in the 97 final. And you know, who would have thought that? Who would have thought that Paul Lambert would have the ability to take Zidane out of the game almost? I mean, it was fantastic. Obviously, Riedler, who we mentioned earlier in the conversation, scored two of the goals. And then I know you guys have tremendous memories of Lars Ricken's goal and clinching the third one, which in essence then clinched the Champions League for the first and only time for Borussia Dortmund so far. But absolutely fantastic. I think it was a stunning achievement by BVB. First of all, getting through the semi-final and then the victory in the final. I don't think it could have been any tougher for them in terms of the quality of opposition that they played there. But I mean, Constantine, you were saying that 97 final was one of the first games where you sort of really sort of sat there and thought, wow. What do you think of that 97 final?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't and analyzing the match, of course, being not and still in kindergarten, but I mean, still the season was pivotal for me because afterwards I got the CD where about the entire Champions League season with all the match or not a match but the highlights of the matches and the highlights of all the previous finals. So if you want to ask me about all the goals that have been scored in European Cup finals, I can tell you because I watched overplayed the CD. It's now unusable. No, but I actually a couple of weeks ago I was asked by a national newspaper here in Germany to write about my favorite match in history, and I chose the 1997 Champions League final, and we watched it because, I mean, just to get a little bit into analysis, and you're absolutely right. I mean, Dortmund was marvelous in terms of defensive ability, especially against Juve. It wasn't a barn burner in terms of like firing power. Dortmund wasn't, you know, outstriking Juventus in terms of like shot statistics and stuff like that. No, of course not. It was Lambert against Zidane. It was also Paulo Sousa against Savic, and you know, you got Jugovic. I mean, and then later against Del Piero when he came in the second half, it was really a defensive masterpiece by Dortmund, because what they really tried to do throughout the match was slowing down Juventus. And when you watch the first 20 minutes are kind of dull, but not for Dortmund, not for Ottmar Hitzfeld, because they were able to slow down Juve, you know, getting kind of the heat out of the match. And when Riedler scored the first goal, it was the first time when the stadium in Munich was basically quiet. Because before that, the Dortmund fans were making a lot of noise, and the Juve fans, of course, were making a lot of noise. I mean, the match was in Munich, so it was kind of close to Torino. And it was quiet, and then Dortmund scored. And then you go from there. And the Ricken goal, of course, is famous for what it was. I think it was Di Livio, the left back, who was not committing to any kind of defensive duty in the second half because they were just running down the left lane. And Ricken was watching him. And it was, yeah, when I get behind him, I have a lot of space. And Peruzzi was always standing in about 12, 15 yards in front of his goal, usually. And I was, because the goal became so famous. But I think it was, when you watch it back, it was really a defensive masterpiece. And sometimes you remember these matches for not the wrong reasons, but sometimes you remember them a little bit falsely. So it was really interesting to watch it. And I think also Ottmar Hitzfeld, when he went on coaching Bayern, it was kind of similar. Bayern was a team that was really stable. That was defensively stable. That was really his where he really paid close attention. because always he was convinced that if you're defensively sound, you're talented attacking players. For Dortmund was Chapuisat and Uitler. Chapuisat was making a lot of energy running down the left side against left lane against Juventus, and then he did the same at Bayern. So yeah, it was really a blueprint for Ottmar Hitzfeld football, what came years later than at Bayern.
So when you said he did the same, you're referring to Ottmar Hitzfeld's style of coaching, because yeah. Obviously Stefan Chapuisat, the Swiss striker, never played for Bayern München. But thank you so much for your recollections. It seems clearly 97 makes a very huge impression on you.
May I come back to Kutowski?
Yeah.
He left the club in summer 96, so he won two championships with Borussia Dortmund.
Yeah, in fact, he left. I'm going to correct the master writer of Borussia Dortmund. According to Wikipedia, he left. This was why my question. It wasn't completely crazy, although it's actually quite feasible. But December 95, he joined TuS Paderborn Neuhaus, which previously was TuS Schloss Neuhaus. And he still was awarded the winner's medal for 95-96. And that was. Yeah. Curiosity, Dieter, I was wondering if you could explain it to me.
No, he was the Spencer season 94-95 and 95-96 in Borussia Dortmund. But I tell you how often he played. One moment. Not very often, but he played. He's a German, he's a champion, a real champion.
Now I have to Google it myself.
Don't Google it on wikipedia.co.uk.
Apparently, there's a controversy brewing here. Yeah,
there you go. But also, just to mention, whilst we're looking at that, obviously, sure. BVB went on to become world champions as well, post the 97. And I know that the competition then perhaps might not be considered... the biggest thing in the world, potentially, but
eight games.
Yeah.
Yeah, the world, what's basically today is the FIFA Club World Cup. Mm. I mean, back then it was just one match against the winner of the Copa Libertadores, Cruzeiro Belo Horizonte. I remember actually watching the match, and there is something because it was. Where was it actually? It was in Tokyo.
Yeah.
I was thinking about, was it in South America? No, it was in Tokyo. And I think because the frame rates or something are different there, or something like the coding of the broadcasting is different, and then it has to be translated into German TV, and like there's some kind of not issue, but it's watching the match, it looked a little bit weird, and the colors looked weird, and just everything looked it didn't look like a typical Bundesliga or Champions League match that is broadcasted by European channel. So I remember that it had a brownish color thing going on. What am I watching here? But I remember that. Yeah, and it was the only success for Nevio Scala as head coach of Borussia Dortmund, because it wasn't much going on with him finishing the season at finishing the season 10th then, which of course major disappointment after winning a Champions League and winning the World Cup, although. Yeah, it wasn't really a big deal, I think. But you can do it on your masthead.
Which ties in perfectly with what Dieter was saying about how Dortmund had this history of collapsing after a major title, and with perhaps the exception of 1991-92, which made it such a remarkable season for me, and one that really hadn't registered on the radar. And it seems really quite remarkable that the club was able to achieve such heights and almost win the Meisterschaft at the time. So Dieter, you found the mystery out of Günter Kutowski.
Yes, I found. In fact, he played 8 games in the Bundesliga in season 94-95, and a number of games in 95-96 too. So he moved. It was in summer 96 that he moved back to Paderborn to TuS Paderborn Neuhaus.
He is
a champion.
Yeah, definitely a champion. 89 Pokalsieger, then 94-95, and 95-96 was the controversial one because Wikipedia is having him down as leaving for in December.
Wikipedia, although I have Wikipedia.
I definitely, as an academic, I definitely
this don't. Is Wikipedia, but not Wikipedia. Don't ask Wikipedia, but ask me.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Over to you, Mark. English football in 1997. You were saying about Manchester United and Martin Kreh. When I interviewed him at the Westfalenstadion in 2017, told me that it was a very uneventful match. The match in Tokyo, he said, we basically flew there the night before. We didn't have any time to settle in. Then we flew straight out again and basically won the cup. And I absolutely concur with you, Konstantin. I posted the video of that match with the Brazilian commentary. And as you say, the footage was very poor. It looked like something from the 1970s, basically. But still, I mean, for me, I remember watching it in the very early hours of the morning, which was one of the games that I did watch of B4B when I was back in England. And it did seem kind of exotic and kind of extraordinary. I suspect, Mark, you probably didn't see the Intercontinental Cup, as it was then called. It then became, I think, the Toyota Cup. Was that right?
Toyota Cup. Yeah, no, I confess it's something I didn't watch.
Absolutely. It's more than understandable. What was the major team then for you in 1997 in English football?
Well, as I say, the team then was obviously Alex Ferguson had then obviously cracked it for Manchester United. They'd gone a long period of time without winning the championship in England. And then obviously once they won it, then sort of the floodgates opened and then they became hugely successful for the next 20 years, really. And that was the thing. They were sort of like the flag bearer, I suppose, for English football on the European front then. And as I say, alluding to that sort of semi-final, I think they were, you know, deeply disappointed that they didn't get past BVB in that semi. But credit to them for sure. Absolutely. But obviously they did go on to succeed and win the treble in 1999, which is a very memorable year for them.
Bayern fans.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. I mean, Bayern seem to have a little bit of a history of losing some interesting European Cup finals. That's for sure.
Indeed, against my English team, Dieter, which I'm sure you know, Aston Villa, 1982 in Rotterdam.
Yeah. But what was interesting, or what was interesting back then compared to today in terms of English football, is that you didn't have the big four, big five, big six, or whatever you want to call it back then. I mean, United was 1997. They were pretty much dominating the league. But behind them, you got a couple of teams like Newcastle United, of course. Who were good, but they weren't like established as the number two or number three. This was much more fluid in terms of who, which team was getting the UEFA Cup spot, for instance. So I think there was a difference between English football, club football in the mid to late 90s compared to today, where we have this established group of five, six teams. Of course, I heard that Newcastle United will crack in there again.
Well, you never know. We shall see.
Well, I mean, I heard they have big plans.
You Saudi Arabian owner.
Yeah, big plans, but execution is still the thing there.
It will be delayed. Yeah, I heard something there. A lot of politics involved.
Yeah, no, but you're absolutely right. I think in United had this period there where they really sort of were unchallenged until Arsene Wenger came into English football, I'd say. And then that changed. And then obviously later on, Jose Mourinho went in at Chelsea and suddenly United had serious challenges again. Ferguson was a great manager and tremendous at reinventing his teams. He probably had three or four different sides, different players, and obviously went on to greatness without doubt.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Dieter, a period of time which I'm not sure, I think all of us can talk about the Jurgen Klopp era, and indeed I'm doing the Liverpool FC podcast on Tuesday talking about Kloppo's last season, which I wrote an article about, which, I mean, there's not much to say about 14-15, but I wanted to see if I could pick your brains for a moment. Do you know this expression, pick your brains?
Yes.
So, for
the moment, it's okay.
The period between, let's say, 2000 and 2005, I guess, which is when the major crisis came. What memories do you have about this time?
A mediocre team. Football wasn't very exciting. The squad was not very exciting. Okay. It all changed when Jürgen Klopp arrived, but forget about the years between 2002 and the championship 2002 and then 2007 when it was summer 2007 when Klopp arrived. Yeah, but I think okay, there was this one cup final was there. It was before Klopp arrived against Bayern Munich when Thomas Doll was in charge in Berlin. In fact, I was there. After extra time, 2-1 for Bayern Munich. And great save by Oliver Kahn. Otherwise, we could have won the game. But okay, that's the only highlight of this year.
Yeah. Sorry, Mark, you were saying?
No, go ahead.
Okay, sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a fairly uneventful time, basically, which leads us on basically neatly into the period, which I think all of us can relate to, which is then the Jurgen Klopp era. But perhaps just before that, we could just say something about the financial crisis of 2005. What was your, as a writer, were you very involved in that time writing about this period, Dieter?
No, not very much. Of course, I did it in the books, but not very much. No.
And you alluded to basically the fact that a lot of the problems came from the stadium expansion and so on, and also the sheer...
We already mentioned it, the title 2002 was a very, very expensive one. The squad was very, very expensive with the Brazilian players, the Amorosa, etc. And the stadium, yes.
Yeah, and
We have to connect to World Cup 2006 because Niebaum had this dream that the semi-final would take place in Dortmund.
Absolutely right, and quite a semi-final it was. If I'm not mistaken, it was Germany-Italy,
Germany-Italy.
Italian went on to win it. But yeah, okay, well, let's go on because of time is flying. Mark, the Jürgen Klopp era from about 2008 onwards, Klopp has obviously made a huge impression. Dieter wrote a book about Jürgen Klopp, and not the only one to have written a book. There's quite a few books out there.
Well, I didn't write about Jürgen Klopp.
You wrote about Liverpool FC.
Liverpool and Jürgen Klopp, yes. But it's not a book about Jürgen Klopp.
Liverpool and Jürgen Klopp, yeah. So what impressions are lasting memories, really, of the first years of Kloppo at Dortmund?
Well, I think for me, when I think of Jürgen Klopp, it's clearly the whole rock and roll football scenario and, yeah, you know, this really aggressive game. Athletes in his team, I think of whenever I think of Jürgen Klopp. And I think that's sort of carried on throughout the eras and into his teams that he has at Liverpool now. But I think from an English perspective, watching Borussia Dortmund, I just found them to be incredibly exciting to watch. I think people want to watch that high-paced game. I think it's a really interesting, contrasting style, I think, to some other football where you have the sort of more tiki-taka, slower-paced sometimes style, where it's just pass, pass, pass. Whereas I think that the excitement comes from watching these guys who are, you know, herring in there, trying to get the ball back as quickly as they can, and they're moving the ball quickly and having fast-paced players in the team that can then exploit those situations. So I think, and then obviously watching Jürgen's antics on the sidelines. How can you not enjoy those? I mean, fantastic. Those are the sort of things that stick in my mind in those era. And obviously at BVB, he's incredibly successful to come in, challenge Bayern and take it away from them and, you know, to win back-to-back titles. And in 2012, winning the double, just, I mean, fabulous. I mean, you guys must have watched a number of those games and actually been present at some of those games. And I'm sure, you know, atmosphere must have been incredible, and the excitement just going to these games must have been fabulous.
Well, of course, absolutely. It's a great, extraordinary period of football. I mean, just to talk about those 2000. I'm wearing the T-shirt, the 2012 yeah. double. I mean, what can I say?
Absolutely.
Constantine, your memories. Do you remember the Kappa shirt, that wonderful Kappa shirt with the little dots on the front, or did you hate it?
I mean, Dortmund over the years had some questionable choices in terms of jersey design, I have to say. Because that's also why there was one reason why I still was rocking the Tomasz Rosicki jersey for quite a while when there were other jerseys out. Because I wasn't really... I mean, the Kappa thing, Werder Bremen was for years, they were working these tightly fitted jerseys. I don't know if they were any kind of given any kind of comfort when you wanted to wear them anywhere else other than the field. Remembering Klopp's time when he came in 2008, I think I always like looked at his period at Dortmund in basically two or three periods. I mean, I've cut it in slices. You have to basically what I call the Tamás Hajnal period, which was the first 2 years, where he really needed some time, he meaning Klopp, to form his team, really get the players he wanted, he needed for his style, for his idea of football. The first 2 years weren't that exciting, actually. But he was all still working with players from the era prior. There was Tomasz Hajnal was just an example, and there were a couple of other players. And slowly but surely, he was really forming his team. Then winning two titles, getting to the Champions League final the year after, and then from there, you saw that there was a downhill development. Basically, even if Dortmund finished as runner-ups in the 2013-14 season, still you saw that it wasn't the same kind of Dortmund team because of all the players that left, and because Klopp was also, I think, not necessarily burned out. But Klopp is one of the coaches in Europe, or in just football history, who's convinced that you have to slightly reinvent your team, your system, your tactics after a considerable period of time. And I think at that point in 2013-14, he wasn't really able to do so anymore with the team he had. He was much more occupied by just filling the gaps and dealing with injured players. It was also something. Even the season when Dortmund reached the Champions League final, if you look back at some of the matches, there are so many injured players and just injuries all over the place. I mean, it was, which sometimes had something to do with the intense style, which I mean, Klopp actually was. I mean, admits that there's something to it, and then the season afterwards, the famous Real Madrid match when Oli Kirsch and Manuel Friedrich played because of injuries, and it was really Klopp wasn't able to enhance the tactics. It was much more occupied by anything else that was going on, everything else that was going on. So yeah, that's my remembrance of Jurgen Klopp, and then of course last season was a little bit of a shit show.
I put a lot of that down to the failures of Ciro Immobile, who actually now has proven himself to be quite a remarkable striker.
Only in Italy.
Yeah, well, it's indeed in Sevilla, he wasn't exactly too impressive, was he? No. Feel as if we should be wrapping it up, but it would be a tragedy not to get Mark's views on the Jurgen Klopp era at Borussia Dortmund.
Yeah, yeah, no. As I say, I think the Klopp era at Borussia Dortmund. To me, he put Borussia Dortmund on the map, certainly outside of Germany, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, don't get me wrong, they were there from a European perspective from 97 and that era. But I think to a big generation of football supporters who watch the European game in general, I think Jurgen Klopp's teams and the way that the style of play and obviously their success. I think it broadened the appeal of Borussia Dortmund under Jurgen Klopp, without doubt. And I think today, you know, there are, as we know, there are many fans in England. Hence, we've got the, you know, the London fan club, that courtesy of Jurgen Klopp are why they love Borussia Dortmund, I would say. So, I mean, I think his appeal has been massive. His personality, the style of play. Yeah, I think his time there is just amazing, really. And obviously, he's gone on to prove that, you know, he can do it at different clubs. That's huge kudos to him as a manager and his style.
Let's bring in Dieter, as you said. Dieter, any final words about the Kloppo era? I feel as if that's a show, on itself. I mean, you could talk so much.
The German final of 2013, and I think that although they lost the game in Wembley, I got the impression that his style to play, his style of football, was much more popular in Germany, in England than the Bayern Munich possession football at that time. And I was always convinced that if he would leave Germany, then he would go to England to the Premier League. And I was convinced that he would go to Liverpool. Don't ask me why not Manchester. But I thought Liverpool would suit him, the city, the club would suit him more than Manchester United, but not one of the London clubs.
Yeah, we did a show on the LFC with Matt from the Liverpool Echo a couple of weeks ago about the similarities between Dortmund and Liverpool. And indeed, there are old images of some friendly match where Kloppo comes down the tunnel at Anfield, and you can see his affection for the club is there, basically. Well, guys, it's been remarkable listening to you all, and I guess we really couldn't finish without kind of looking at tomorrow's amazing game. I think everybody's feeling, you know, a sense of nervousness, all the spotlight, the amazing Rampenlicht is on the German Bundesliga, on Germany's ability to manage football in a time of a pandemic of a corona virus, and which has been so widespread, which has caused so many of us to spend the last 2 months mostly at home or, you know, basically in different states of kind of undoingness. But I really feel like this is a huge breakthrough, not just for German football, but also for the management of the corona crisis. What are your feelings? And then finally, could I get everybody to just throw in their predictions for tomorrow's game? And let me start with a prediction. I'm going to be a bit negative. I think everything's going to go exceptionally well, but I feel the game is going to end 2-2 tomorrow, which is one better than it did last year when I was at the Westfalenstadion with Marcel Raducanu watching the, what was it, the 3-4 result? Or was it 2-4? I don't recall.
2-4.
Yeah. Dieter, what is your impression?
Tomorrow it will be 4-2.
I love it.
The other way around. It will be the other way around.
I love it. Let's have it.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that it was a good idea to continue with the schedule and with the program. In my opinion, we stopped the lockdown a bit too early, and maybe that we will face the same problem again in autumn, and that would be terrible for the economy, for the football, and so on and so on. And I'm not even convinced that we will finish this season. Because, you know, there are already some things already happened, and maybe that players become infected, and so.
Remarkable prediction. Well, indeed, Konstantin, we had problems with Dynamo Dresden and FC Köln.
And the same, not only today, it was with Heiko Herrlich, the manager of Augsburg, went to a supermarket. Look, if you look at what happened in Berlin with Kalou, they all bash Kalou, but in fact, it was an athletic coach who shook hands. Then the way they took the test, my wife is a doctor, and she's doing this test here in our village in Altenberg, and she started to laugh when she saw what happened there in Berlin. And we have there are hundreds of young players in the age of 18 till 30, 31, 32. And I'm not sure that these hundreds of young players, and I could understand it, always stick to the rules. I remember I was in the age of 20 or 25. And from my own experience, I'm convinced that the brain of a man is a building site until the age of 26 or 27. Therefore, I'm quite convinced that things like in Berlin will happen at other clubs.
Boy, can I relate to that. And I just hope that basically there's going to be some flexibility in the way things are managed. But my having lived in Germany a long time, more than 10 years, my feeling is if any country is going to manage this successfully, it'll be Germany. And all you need to do is look at the fatality compared to the UK, which is one-fifth of British fatalities, to realize that something's gone right. And yes, above all,
too much admiration for Germany in England.
Don't mention the war, Peter.
Yeah, in the past it was easier than today. If you go today to England, say, oh, Merkel, brilliant, brilliant, and so on. And it's the green policy, but in the past it was easier.
On this podcast, we love to mention how great Borussia Dortmund are, and we've got 1,001 reasons. Mark, your prediction for the match tomorrow? And we're going to do a Zoom, aren't we? We're going to get on
Zoom. Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to be lining up a few beers and looking forward to sitting down to watch it, even though it's going to be very odd just listening to the, you know, hearing the players' voices while they're on the pitch. That's going to be quite strange. And I'm fascinated just to see how it all works out, because it's watching football in a very different manner and you know, what the protocols are and so on. But I think BVB are going to be too strong for Schalke, and I think they're going to win comfortably. I think they'll be 3-0 up after an hour, and then, a bit like Constantine said, I think the pace then drops off and it probably just peters out, and you know, they might concede a late goal. So I'm going to go 3-1 BVB tomorrow.
3-1, nice, 4 goals as well, and all in the right direction. And I hope your beers will not be Italian beers tomorrow.
I shall make a special effort.
I just heard earlier that BT Sport want to join us on the Zoom for a live chat, so that should be pretty cool. Okay. Always good publicity for the fan club. Constantine, your results for the match tomorrow, and what do you feel about the current situation? Is it tenable? I mean, the outcome apparently, if of the season not being able to be seen through, is at the moment is pretty precarious, to be frank with you.
Yeah, I mean, especially the first match day. It feels like a first match day, right? Opening season day, or the first match day after restart. It's not really about the football itself, about the game. Mm-hmm. It's more about the circumstances, the precautions, what's really going on. I mean, I will cover the weekend for BBC and ESPN, and I mean, I won't really cover the results and the scoreboards, because who cares? quite frankly, a lot of people, especially outside Germany, but even in Germany, don't really care about the scoreboards, but more about what's, will they really pan out? Will they really be successful, what they are trying to do? Or will it be a huge failure? So that's really the main question. So I haven't really put so much thought into the matches and who will play and what's with the coaches and stuff like that, because, well, we will see. I think the football itself, if the thing is successful and they can go on with the season, I think the football will become a major focus in maybe 2 or 3 weeks when everything has settled down a little bit. But I'm still doubtful that it will. I mean, I'm much more optimistic than others in Germany that, and I think there is a good, fair chance that might go through and they will finish the season in late June or maybe early July. But I also see the chance that it won't finish and they will just cancel the season outright in, I don't know, in 3 or 4 weeks, because so many teams have to go into quarantine and then it's basically over. Basically, the normal tracing situation, but times 4. So if you got a 5-6 teams in quarantine at the same time, that it's basically over. That's about that. I don't know. But in terms of like how Germany is dealing with the pandemic, there are other things happening or are about to happen that to me are much more concerning, like the opening of the daycare centers on Monday. with like thousands and tens of thousands of small kids going back, going out. The primary schools are open. That's much, in my opinion, it's much more concerning than 300 people in a stadium. For the wider society when it comes to the pandemic. I mean, that's because I think from a societal perspective, 300 people in a stadium and even in certain sections, I mean, I will be in a section 2 in the stands at Frankfurt. Only 100 people will dare in this section. I'm not really that concerned. I think there are other things that I'm much more concerned about, also the reopening of restaurants and stuff like that. That's yeah. I mean, I'm warmer in the stadium than in a restaurant right now. Just saying. When I look at the when I look at the precautions that are that the clubs are taking, or that the German league is taking, I mean, there are weak points in terms of this hygiene protocol, but it's I mean, you can see that it might be doable. Of course, I read on Twitter one person was tweeting the German Football League has basically neglected one major factor here in terms of setting up this hygiene protocol, that it involves football players. which are not necessarily the smartest and most disciplined people in the world. But yeah, so to round it up, the match, I think it will be a close call, 2-1 for Dortmund. As I said, I think it will be an intense affair for the first 40-50 minutes. And then it might be become a little bit dull because the players have just heavy legs and, you know, stamina is not there right now. And maybe even some players are a little bit overwhelmed and don't give it their all. Maybe even there are some players who are just, you know, happy when it's over and they can get home. Who knows? I think it will be a close call, 2-1, something like that.
I got you. And hugely thrilling to think that you're actually going to be tomorrow at the Waldstadion for Eintracht Frankfurt's game. Is it still Waldstadion or is it Commerz Arena now? I never know. I hate these new names. I'll never call the Dortmund Stadium the Signal Iduna Park. That's the first thing you learn when you join the Borussia Dortmund Fan Club London, as you probably join any other fan club. There are so many, 900 around the world. It's Westfalenstadion.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. It's been absolutely amazing. One draw and three wins predicted. And next week on the show, we'll have a wonderful football finance expert to talk about the differences between Dieter, the marvelous Germany and German football, and how it's managed so much better than English football. Again, that's just an opinion. But I'm probably the big enthusiast of German football in London, at least. Right. Okay, guys. Well, thank you so much. Let's wrap it up with that. And Dieter, where can we find you on social media if somebody would like to contact you?
On Facebook.
Yeah.
And on Twitter.
Uh-huh. And what would be your Twitter handle, please?
What is it? I've on Twitter only since 2 weeks.
So on Facebook, at
I found my followers. Wait a moment. I help you.
I'm going to join your Twitter page straight after this.
My goodness. Julio, you become my follower?
Become your follower. Konstantin, I know you can shoot these things off.
Of course, yeah. You can follow me on Twitter, cc_ecknr. Follow me there and I will share all the stuff I'm doing in terms of, you know, texts, videos, articles, stories about the German Bundesliga, but also about German politics, economic affairs, a lot of stuff in English. So also for interesting for the international audience, I think.
I sent you a message. Oh, it's better. At D Marmeling.
At D Marmeling. Good stuff. And Mark, as usual, per fax, email. And
I'm very much in diesel school, really, a little bit old fashioned. But people can reach me via email at mark@sportslineuk.com.
Okay. And the Borussia Dortmund fan club meet up at the Naughty Bar in London, in Cleveland Street, just off Oxford Street. When there's a game, come down, have a Dortmunder beer.
We're from Dortmund. We have our brewery.
Yeah, what? We have Union beer. And
I'm sure the owner will be American.
we get a Brinkhoffs for you when you're coming to London. Thank you, great. Gentlemen.
Good.
Enjoy the derby. Enjoy Bundesliga, the best league in the world. And I'll catch you soon.
Thanks, Jeff. Okay.